Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the third episode of Project Rostrum Podcast, where some plebes try to unpack news and events around the world. This is your host, Brian Krieger, and I'm here with my co-host, Stephen Shepherd.
Hey, everybody. Hope everybody had a good Thanksgiving.
All right. We have another round of big stories, including the FCC attempt to undo net neutrality protections led by Chairman Ajit Pai, who is apparently bold enough to charge forward to restore internet freedom from the constraints of net neutrality, but is apparently not confident enough in his plan to put it before congressional hearings. We're going to take a deep dive into a little-known exemption concerning religious freedom and the latest iteration of the GOP tax plan and what it means for religious organizations and donations in an age of Citizens United protected super PACs. But first, our latest experiment in helping listeners stay informed about the world at large or around the world. Tuesday started with the harrowing story of a North Korean defector attempting to escape by crossing the heavily guarded border. The incident was partially caught on film, in which you can see him driving south toward the DMZ when fleeing on foot while being fired upon by the North Korean military. His vehicle was apparently disabled, at which point he decided to ditch it and continue on foot. He suffered multiple gunshot wounds to the abdomen and chest before collapsing on a pile of leaves after crossing the border, according to a Newsweek article from November 23rd. Three South Korean soldiers crawled to his rescue with the assistance of three U.S. soldiers and were awarded an Army Commendation Medal. According to a BBC story from November 21st, the defector had an infestation of parasitic worms that were complicating his injuries, but he has since been stabilized and was reported to be watching South Korean films as per his own request from the hospital bed. Although around 1,000 North Koreans attempt to flee each year, very few attempt to escape by directly crossing the DMZ. His escape was one such attempt that occurred near the village of Panmunjom, near a heavily guarded border area. Most refugees attempt to escape on the shared border with China, which is more lightly guarded. China, who considers them illegal immigrants, not refugees, typically repatriates them to North Korea. So did you read much about this one?
Yeah, I did. I watched the video too, and that guy, he was trying. He gave you his all, and he got away too.
Yeah, you can see the tracer fire when he got out of the car from the automatic weapons. Looked like little green laser beams.
And then the one guy, he started to chase him all across the border, but he stopped. The South Korean soldiers, Billy crawled over to the guy to grab him, like to pull him to safety.
Yeah, I read about that part as well. It was like sort of like a concerted effort from the Americans and the South Koreans, and they went in to pull him out on their belly, I guess, while the Americans were sort of covering their positions and whatnot. They probably don't have to risk themselves by going out there. Like, North Koreans and South Koreans sort of consider themselves to be kindred spirits. You know, like, they're of one Korea, just currently they're separated by a war. So South Koreans will risk injury to rescue North Koreans who make the attempt to defect.
If it's 1,000 a year, then I don't know how many actually want to do that, and how many realize that they're not in a good place. That, you know, that's Kim Jong-un.
I think it's more common in near the border of China because of that reason exactly. Like, they see how they can probably look over the border literally because it's kind of a mountainous region, and see how other people are living, more or less, you know? And this guy,
that'd be horrible.
One of the stories noted that the parasitic infection was indicative of the sort of healthcare situation there. This guy is a member of the military and had a parasitic infection that, like, one of the parasites they pulled out of him was 11 centimeters long. Damn. Like, it was a parasitic worm infection. Pretty gross stuff.
How's the recovery going so far? Is he still getting...
I think he's alive and stabilized. They said the life-threatening injuries had more or less been avoided at this point. Okay. And he was just watching movies, pretty much. It's kind of crazy to think about. He was in the military one day.
He's watching movies, something he didn't get to do before?
Who knows, man? Probably don't even get to own a TV up there. Yeah, I don't know what the conditions are exactly in North Korea. I've never taken the time to look into it. I just know that it's definitely not a fun place to be. I mean, the fact that he wanted to watch South Korean movies, like, as soon as he got out. Like, you know, he got shot
like this,
in the chest and abdomen, had an infection removed, and he's like, can I watch movies? And they're like, yeah, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
You know,
just stuff like this just makes me glad I live in America.
Yeah, indeed, man. Indeed.
Land of the free. We're working on it.
All right. So moving on to the next story. In an interesting move to undercut EA's attempt at monetizing Star Wars Battlefront 2, the online community tried to promote the idea that EA was marketing gambling at children. The idea first caught the attention of the Belgian government, which took the charge fairly seriously. EA has withdrawn the function in what appears to be a temporary measure for now. The Belgian government is looking to draw up a proposal to the EU to ban such practices in the future, as reported by VTM in Belgium on November 21st. This was apparently echoed by a move from Representative Chris Lee of Hawaii, who appears to be considering this predatory behavior on the part of EA and is looking into legislation this year to prohibit this sort of mechanism from being targeted at children in a PC Gamer article from November 21st as well. So this one sort of throws back to my little rant last week about EA's crappy practices when it comes to monetizing their games. And yeah, it appears that other countries actually have laws that don't like this sort of thing. And they have politicians who will take action.
Well, I mean, we'll see how it goes. I hadn't actually heard anything about this until you brought it up today. But if that's against the law in those countries, then I wonder if it's going to be they just have a different version of the game come out in those countries, or if they're going to completely stop doing those things.
There are companies that do go that route. They develop their games in such a way that it complies with the laws of other countries, in World of Warcraft, for instance. I'm only using this as an example because it's a popular game with which many gamers are familiar. The undead race in World of Warcraft is called something else, and they don't appear to have you can't see their bones and stuff. Like, they don't look like zombies like they do in other countries. Because they call them the Forsaken, I guess, and they're just, mutated. They're not considered to be dead like they are in the regular game, because this is illegal in China to show dead bodies in a video game somehow.
Okay.
I'm not sure about this. If somebody knows better than I do on this, I haven't played World of Warcraft in years, but I do remember that being a thing.
Another thought, if it does make some changes to the game, then maybe it'll set a precedent for some new laws in this country.
Well, there is one of the guys that was speaking at the forum that Chris Lee held in Hawaii to talk about this. He held a little mini forum about it to kind of go over his intention. The guy said, this is typical behavior that you see in the mobile industry. Like, for instance, if anyone has ever played Clash of Clans or a game like this, you can buy sort of time in the form of gems. And a lot of games have things like this where you can spend money to kind of move your progress forward. But this game, most of the time, these games are free to download, and the way that they pay for them is through these monetization models after the fact. Battlefront 2 is a AAA title that you have to purchase for $60 that you're playing on a system that most likely cost you well over $300 to purchase to begin with anyway. And on top of all of these things that you have to spend to even be able to access this game, they want you to buy game-affecting quote loot boxes that will have an effect on the gameplay. This is not cosmetic changes. A lot of games do this sort of thing with cosmetic stuff, like Dota, League of Legends, Heroes of the Storm. They don't have gameplay changing things that you can purchase, but they have sort of skins, cosmetic things that you can purchase to make changes. EA, in all of their greed, is trying to combine all these things. They want to charge you for the game, and they want to charge you for the chance to earn things in the game that do more than just affect the cosmetic appearance of whatever character or sort of kit you happen to be playing at the time. And obviously, being a Star Wars game, this is targeted at children. So lawmakers are looking at this and kind of I think there was some math in a Reddit thread that I read where it talked about the amount of money that you would have to spend or the amount of hours that you would have to grind in Battlefront 2. And the average was $2,000 or 4,000 hours to unlock everything with the loot boxes, which is absurd.
That's a lot of money to spend on a game.
Yeah.
To even want to have somebody spend that much money on a game you developed, that's greedy.
It kind of is,
$2,000 just to play? Oh, man,
I mean, and this is I've probably spent over the time, I actually played World of Warcraft back in the day, and I played it for years, and I probably spent $1,200, $1,300, but this is over the course of years.
Monthly subscriptions and all.
Yeah, and you pay a monthly subscription, and there's other things you can sometimes buy through, like, purchasing and whatnot. Yeah, it's just greed. But we've spent way too much time on this one already. I'm going to move on to the next subject.
Cool, man.
All right. Now we get to the somber stuff. Egypt suffered one of the worst terrorist attacks in modern history on Friday, November 24th. The death toll has reported to risen to 305 people, as the latest reporting, and the Islamic State appears to have taken responsibility. I'm going to notate that by saying I'm not sure if they've taken responsibility, but witnesses on the scene were reported by the media as having seen IS flags on the attacker. So that's my caveat to that statement.
Okay.
The attack was conducted at Al Radwa Mosque near the town of Bir Al Abed, and it took place during prayer. This is a Friday, so this is like the Islamic Sunday, just for reference. Around 25 to 30 gunmen, according to Reuters witness accounts on November 24th, participated in the attack, reportedly wearing military-style uniforms and using bombs while firing indiscriminately into crowds of people while barricading doors and windows to trap victims inside. This sort of commando attack has been done before by both the Islamic State in Paris, albeit on a smaller scale, and by another group that preceded the Islamic State in Mumbai, India, utilizing explosives and gunfire to spur panic, and then opening fire utilizing secondary explosives in crowds of fleeing people to increase the carnage. Attackers were so numerous that they were even shooting at ambulances arriving to treat the wounded and using cars to set on fire as roadblocks. Before Friday's attacks, militants typically targeted the military, police, and non-Muslim religious sites such as Christian churches and pilgrimage sites in Egypt. This attack has escalated the aggression to include Muslim places of worship for the first time, targeting Sufis, who are viewed by hardliners to be heretical. President Fatah al-Sisi, who led a coup to overthrow Egypt's former president, Mohamed Morsi, of the Muslim Brotherhood, after Morsi sparked massive protests in an attempt to consolidate power for life, has promised a heavy crackdown against the responsible parties. Egypt practices a zero-tolerance policy under President Sisi when it comes to terrorist attacks, utilizing military airstrikes and raids within its own borders and giving long prison sentences to captured insurgents. Today, November 26th, Reuters reported Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who himself has been under international scrutiny for what looks to be a crackdown on corruption or an attempt at consolidation of power in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, invited officials from many Muslim-majority nations to Riyadh. The Crown Prince would like to encourage a more moderate and tolerant version of Islam within his own ultra-conservative country and has been a fairly vocal critic of hardliners. The group has called itself the Islamic Military Counterterrorism Coalition, looks to facilitate counterterrorism efforts in an international capacity by providing means for members to request assistance from each other for such initiatives. Notably, Iran, Syria, and Iraq, and Qatar were not invited to the summit. Turkey and Yemen also appear to have called for support against their respective insurgent factions, the Kurds in Turkey and the Houthi in Yemen, the latter of which may be suffering the worst humanitarian crisis of modern times. General Saleh of Saudi Arabia, the coalition's secretary, has said the coalition is not about creating a Sunni bloc to counter Iranian influence, but to counter terrorism, also according to Reuters.
Man, that's a lot to take in, actually.
Yeah.
That's a lot going on. Like, there's like power struggle, you know, all over the place over there, and it's
the Middle East is
ugly,
heavily factionalized. And I think a lot of people, one of the things I saw pretty commonly was, you know, why are terrorists attacking Muslims? I guess it's not known, but Shia and Sunni infighting is common. This was part of the problem in Iraq. Was Iraq is mostly Shia. And a lot of these Shia people looked to take revenge against their oppressors when they came into power backed up by us. And it was our responsibility to sort of mitigate this as much as we could. Like, this was a big problem in Mosul, was sort of just irresponsible kind of crackdown. And that's a problem because if you're coming into power, you have to be a peacemaker, not a source of revenge. You're trying to, like, you don't want another civil war. You're trying to avoid war for the future. And it's really hard to be a peacemaker.
Mm, it's so, some things aren't going so well.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, Egypt recently had a military coup against their sitting elected president, and this guy is going to be up for election soon as well. So we'll see how that goes. He's promised stability, and there have been multiple attacks in Egypt over the last few years since he's been in charge, after they deposed President Morsi. And this is the worst of the worst. 305 people. This is a lot. There's, I think, 27 children among the dead.
Damn, that's awful.
And
it's awful anybody gets killed, but...
Yeah, and while I give credit to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia for trying to do something to bring this stuff together, I don't think it's necessarily a good idea to leave out the Iranians, the Syrians, the Iraqis, and the Qataris. The Iranians are the ideological sort of headpiece for Shia. Iraq is our ally now because we have deposed their country and we're trying to stabilize it, and we want to maintain good relations with Iraq. Saudi Arabia is also our ally. So these bridges need to be built between these nations in order to facilitate some sort of peacemaking process. This is also part of the complication in Syria. The Syrian government, even though it is an oppressive shithole, is also fighting ISIS, which gives Russia a lot, like Russia's propaganda there says that the US is supporting ISIS by going against the Syrian government. All of this stuff is very complicated, but it just kind of like goes to the point, like, you just can't bomb your enemies to death and win the fight. That's never going to work. It's never worked in history. The only reason that we're at peace now with Germany and Japan and South Korea, for the most part, it's kind of like goes to the whole South Korea-North Korea conflict, is that we built a bridge in Japan. We helped Japan rebuild after we dropped two nuclear weapons on them. In Germany, we invaded Germany from the east and the west, and it took a long time, but eventually we reunified the country and sort of wrested control from the Soviets in the late 80s, early 90s. And, you know, like, these are long-term initiatives. Germany was split after World War II. I lived in Germany when I was a kid, and it was called West Germany because it was still split. When I left, it was called Germany. So I kind of lived through that era. And, like, think about that. I lived there in the 1980s.
Yeah.
This is 40 years after the end of World War II. These initiatives, we've been fighting in Iraq for over 10 years. This conflict is not going to resolve itself next year. It's not going to resolve itself if Trump is president for the next 7 years, if he gets reelected again. It's not going to resolve itself in that time. We're still going to have to be invested in peacemaking. And like I said, the more people we blow up, the more incidents that we have, like last week's episode with the New York Times sort of revealing the Pentagon kind of covering up the amount of civilian casualties, the more of this crap that we have, the harder a job it's going to be peacemakers, actual peacemakers. You know, you have to, that's the point of fighting, in my opinion. Like, you fight because there are people that are just not interested in peace and they think you can beat them, or they think that they can beat you. You have to, these people, you got to kill them because they're going to try to kill you. I fully acknowledge that.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, you have to draw the line and be like, okay, we're going to try to figure out a way where everybody can live together. And you have to, and this shit doesn't happen in 10 years. It doesn't happen in 5 or 1 year. It happens over decades.
Well, it's
like multi generations. I don't like, I feel like our country in the last few decades has just been too short sighted when it comes to this kind of stuff. It's going to take a lot, man. I hope that Saudi Arabia is making the right calls. I hope this is just not an attempt by the Crown Prince to sort of consolidate his own power or whatever. I hope that he is genuinely interested in sort of helping to modernize Islam. This would be a huge step, because Saudi Arabia is like the religious leader when it comes to Sunni Islam. And ISIS is a Sunni extremist faction. So pitting these two people against each other is a big deal, you know? Like, him being vocal about this, it makes him a target of these guys, absolutely. Like,
well, the countries you mentioned that he left out, Iran, Syria, Iraq, and Qatar, not being invited to the summit, has there been talk about that since then? You think that something may change there?
there was a story of involving the Russians about doing something about Syria involving these countries. So the big thing is going to be for the Iranians and the Saudis to talk. Like, those two entities have to sit down and figure out a way that they can live in the same region without trying to undermine each other constantly. Because this is what happens. Something happens, we decapitate a state, somebody else decapitates a state. Like, this is exactly what happened in Libya, this is exactly what is happening in Syria now, and it's exactly what happened in Iraq. The leadership vacuum appears, and it gets filled in by whoever is ready to fill it in. Like, that's just the way things go. Like, this is a data point now that we can absolutely say is real. Like, Libya is a crap hole compared to what we had before. I don't know if it's going to get any better. We just did a thing last week on slavery in Libya. You destabilize a government, it's not necessarily better off if you don't take steps to restabilize it. And if you're going to be the person who is going to be the destabilizer, which very often we seem to choose this route, we also need to know that this comes with the burden of being in charge of restabilizing. That takes money, that takes blood. We have to be invested in that. And I just feel personally like we have been short-sighted when it comes to dealing with foreign policy. And we haven't been thinking about the long term, you know, like, where do we see ourselves in 10 or 20 years in regards to this problem? We're not thinking like, in my opinion.
It's hopefully not fighting still.
The biggest story of the week appears to be the FCC's attempt to restore internet freedom by undermining the previously enacted policy attempting to protect consumers from bad practice by ISPs, placing them under Title II regulation as public utilities. The regulation, widely known as net neutrality, forces ISPs to essentially treat all traffic equally by not allowing them to practice any sort of throttling based on bandwidth usage or service usage. They released a 200-page document detailing the effort on Thanksgiving holiday, possibly thinking it would go largely unnoticed. Now, there are three major lines of attack on net neutrality that kind of go as follows. Title II is a Depression-era rule, the regulation discouraged investment, and the internet wasn't broken before 2015. Now, this is a long and complex subject for which an hour-long podcast is not a place to completely dissect it. And you can read a lot of this stuff, both for and against these themes, like consistently repeating to varying degrees. Title II was actually revised in 1996 in the Telecommunications Act. So that is pretty easy to kind of set aside that argument. This is how our country works. We have laws, we revise laws, we pass new laws. But certain old laws sometimes provide a framework for things that we will do in the future. And that's what happened with Title II and the 1996 Telecommunications Act. One of the other common arguments against net neutrality with reference to the 1996 Act is that the law should be unfettered by state and local regulation. This is actually in the text. But the full text of that line, if you actually go and read the Telecommunications Act, kind of debunks the argument itself. It says, quote, "To preserve the vibrant and competitive free market that presently exists for the internet and other interactive computer services, unfettered by federal and state regulations." This is the written intention of the Telecommunications Act. There's a lot more of this in the act, but to preserve a vibrant and competitive free market that presently exists for the internet. Now, I don't think anyone could make a reasonable argument that the internet exists in a vibrant and competitive free market based on the fact that most people have one option for an internet service provider. We'll just ask Steven right now, how many options do you have for an internet service provider in your home?
Charter, and that's it. I mean, there's HughesNet, but HughesNet is, you get the 8 gigs a month for like $80 at high speed, and then it slows down to useless.
Throttled.
Yeah.
Which is technically illegal.
Yeah, that's
according to regulations that are not being enforced by the FCC.
And then other than that, I got Charter.
And I have a similar situation. I actually have Frontier, but my other option is Comcast. Comcast is the one that most people use. Seattle's got more modern internet infrastructure, so there are options in some places. But most people, like if you look at the market share when it comes to ISPs, Time Warner and Comcast control the vast majority of it. I think when I lived in Hawaii, Time Warner was my only choice. You had no other choice. You had to get cable, and it was Time Warner. You could get DSL, but DSL was nice back in the day. It doesn't provide the bandwidth you need for sort of modern internet usage nowadays in the home, with things like multiple people using video streaming on multiple devices in a house that has, you know, if you have two people, they can be streaming video at the same time, most likely. They're probably doing it on different devices.
Yeah, so, see, I can also get it through AT&T, like through phone lines here. Just it's the place that I'm at, they don't have the newest lines, so it would, I don't remember what my, I think it was like 6 megabytes upload speed or download speed was all I was going to get. So it's like super slow.
Yeah.
Not even really enough to do anything with.
The other thing is like this initial infrastructure for the internet, this stuff is, these companies didn't, this is another like common sort of mythology. These companies didn't pay for this stuff. They didn't put the money up for the infrastructure. They were subsidized by the government to invest in this infrastructure. So our tax dollars paid for the infrastructure. They don't upgrade it. They want to do, like, their plans are wacky. Like, using, like, putting more people on wireless-type networks, like cell phones, which anybody who's used a cell phone knows that your 4G is not nearly as good as your cable internet. And if you've ever had fiber optic, then you know that your wireless internet is nowhere near as good as your fiber optic. I get a 30-30 megabit per second upload and download. Nice. And that, yeah, like that's the advantage of fiber optic. That should be something that's more common.
60-30, 60 download.
Yeah, yeah. It's hard, man, because like, I mean, fiber optic has its sort of own thing. Like, it's only, like, this is getting really technical, but you can't do duplex mode in fiber optic, so you have to have an up connection and a down connection. So they're automatically, like, separated to begin with. So that's sort of what assists in that regard to, like, have, but it's expensive. Like, these are glass fibers, and it's expensive to lay this stuff. Companies don't want to put the money in it if they don't think they're going to make money, which is sort of one of the counter arguments, but they've never done that. We've always subsidized this kind of thing.
That actually is pretty expensive to put the stuff in the ground. I actually used to do that when, let's see, 18 years ago when I was 18, and I got 56 cent a foot, and we would lay 3,000-5,000 feet a week. And I'm the low guy on the totem pole, and that's what I got paid. So, you know what the higher ups are getting paid. That's like, you know, they're making the money.
And it's a complicated subject for sure, but a lot of these companies seem to want to like take the position that they're not, you know, like they've paid for it, and if we want to expand, then they need to be able to charge us most money. They didn't pay for this stuff. They were subsidized to pay for it. We had to influence them with subsidies to pay for expanding sort of into broadband stuff. I remember one of the big things in the early days when I used to do the cable installation stuff with my dad was upgrading from RG6 to RG11, I think. I can't remember what the exact names of it are. But there was the old cable, which wouldn't get any of the new, you couldn't use a new box, like any of the new fancy equipment on it. You had to use old equipment. And that was the only way that it worked. They offered the sort of digital packages, the digital sort of stuff, and this would encourage people to pay the extra money to get the upgraded lines in their house. And you also, like, they weren't paying for the lines at the poles, though. Like, that was the company paying for that. And I suspect that that was probably subsidized by the government to offer upgrades. Maybe you have some insight into that point?
No, I didn't even know that was subsidized by the government. I didn't know it got paid for that way.
Yeah, I mean, that's how subsidies work. It's just the government encourages spending in a particular thing that they think will be good for America.
So the government pays for infrastructure and they're trying to bank off of it.
Yeah, nice. That's the point of taxes. Okay, the second argument about investment seems trite, as there are only 2 years worth of data on the impact since 2015, which is quite an ironic position to take considering the ample evidence supporting Title II regulation based on very real lawsuits brought against various ISPs prior to 2015 for abusing customers with throttling and other monetization efforts. This seems to more or less debunk the third argument as well, as anyone paying attention to the efforts that were made by service providers to control as much of the content as possible by throttling, blocking certain services, charging content providers based on customers' usage, which in turn impacted the cost of these services, partially subscription-based content services such as Netflix. Now, if you do think back, if you were paying attention when some of this was going on, some ISPs were throttling people's ability to watch Netflix, claiming that Netflix was consuming too much bandwidth on their service. Now, a lot of smart people have written about this at length, and I'm not going to get into the details of it, but the ISP is just supposed to provide you with the pipe. You should be able to choose where you want to utilize your bandwidth however you want to utilize it. If you decide that you want to consume a lot of movie content via Netflix, that's your choice. You shouldn't have to pay extra, and Netflix should not have to pay extra if this can be facilitated by the pipe. And that's kind of the way that it works. It gets a lot more complicated, but I'll say, if you're using TCP/IP, which 99.99999% of everyone is using, almost every packet looks the same when it is, when it has data. There's this thing called the maximum transition unit, which every program has to break itself down for in order to package data to send over the internet. The number of packets that you receive is kind of based on your bandwidth. The bigger a pipe that you have access to, the more you can go up and down. And what one company was trying to do was trying to influence Netflix to pay more because Netflix was a commonly used service through their ISP. And this sort of legislation the FCC proposes is counter to that. It's not the way that you want to go. These companies have a sort of proven history of being abusive. And there are people that make arguments against net neutrality. It's my opinion that these arguments are uninformed, or these people are just sort of toeing the line of whatever their ideology supports the belief of. I think that government regulation is bad, and you're not going to convince them otherwise, which it's a free country. You believe what you want to believe. I'm going to argue against that, though, and I'm going to say that your opinion is uninformed. You got anything to add to this?
Well, what you were just now saying, without some regulation, it's just... opens them up to be able to charge people for whatever they want to be able to charge them. And, you know, that's going to hurt a lot of people. There's a lot of people that's really their only, like, access to the outside world. And, you know, it's just not right what they're doing or what they're trying to do.
We're a free country. These companies have had ample opportunity to prove that they have customers in mind when they do this stuff. And there are, like I said, this is backed up by data. There are lawsuits where these companies, they're bad business practices. They've been sued for this stuff, like, routinely. There's plenty of evidence. You can look up TechDirt articles on this. There's TechCrunch articles on this. They go over this stuff in detail in a lot of these tech articles if you really want to dig into the meat of this stuff. So anyone's more than welcome to look at this stuff. And I mean, if you want to question me on this stuff, you can absolutely, like, I'll reply to comments on the SoundCloud if people want to ask.
Oh, yes,
have
definitely.
Me comment on this stuff. For sure. I am eager to have a debate and just tell you how misinformed you are about what net neutrality actually does. This is not government regulation that's increasing the cost of your services or your taxes because of their interference. It's just a set of rules that companies have to follow. And if they don't, they get sued and they have to pay money. Now, that may add stuff to your bottom line, but that's how the justice system works. If you screw up and break the law, there are consequences. So, yeah, I'm willing to go to bat for this one and call people misinformed on this if they don't support net neutrality, because this is something that's very important. And you can look in any country that doesn't have this sort of regulation and see what a shit show their internet is. Portugal is the often cited example. All right. I'm going to move on from this one to the second part of this segment. I know this is getting drafty, but on Friday, November 24th, The Hill reported that Senator Susan Collins of Maine would oppose the FCC's attempt to remove Title II protections, making her the first GOP senator to oppose the move by the FCC and giving net neutrality its first Republican ally. Ajit Pai and the FCC are also being investigated by the New York State Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman for an incident involving the use of fake identities, commenting on the SEC site in support of their move to remove Title II protections. The FCC has refused to cooperate and provide requested evidence to the New York Attorney General's office, according to an article published by Schneiderman himself on November 21st via Medium. This has got some weird nuances to it. Like, if this didn't happen, why are you refusing to provide the evidence that would exonerate you? Unless you're afraid that that's not what's going to happen. Like, what is Chairman Pai doing at the FCC? Is he trying to bot his way into, you know, like, is this what's going on? We're going to have, like, bots kind of trying to influence people's opinion? Why are dead people making comments in support of this stuff? That's essentially what the New York Attorney General is saying, is, like, dead New Yorkers were commenting on the FCC's site in support of net neutrality. How does that happen? You know, like, this is some crazy stuff that's going on. So I guess I'll just ask the first question. Do you think the move by Collins is going to do anything? Do you think this could spark some sort of legislative effort by Congress to intervene in this situation? Or what are your thoughts?
And I certainly hope so. I hope it gets people thinking about this, because
in Congress,
that affects everybody.
Because I think, yeah.
I know, but they still got to think about this. Like, they have
they need to take action.
The decisions they're making are affecting everybody.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the critiques, is like, these are five guys taking a vote, and three of them are going to make sweeping changes that are going to affect a huge part of the economy, and something that a lot of people use every day. So
it's scary that so few people can affect so many.
Yeah, it's one of the things that we're learning in this new era of American politics, for certain, is that, I mean, what it really comes down to, there's very few people that can make some sweeping changes to stuff. Sort of consolidation of power, I guess, in the executive branch, that definitely seems like there's some problems with. And we, like, a lot of people were saying, you know, there was too much power in the executive branch when Obama was in charge, and we should be doing something about this. But the Democrats, they were in charge. They didn't see the need. They thought, even if they lose power, the next guy would sort of observe the norms. And Trump has blown that out of the water,
yeah.
In my opinion. Like, we are going into unknown times, depending on who gets elected next, whether it be Trump or some Democrat. Like, you know, Democrat X, who knows who's going to be elected next. We're definitely in uncharted waters when it comes to lawmaking in America, for certain. And yeah, the outcry against this has been, like, super vocal. Some of the most upvoted threads on Reddit. There's petitions going around. Subreddits you wouldn't believe were talking about. Everyone was talking about this because this is the internet. Everyone who uses the internet is going to be affected by this. So the impact and the outcry is far-reaching. And I think Chairman Pai may have been underestimating the sort of backlash that he's going to face. So we'll see what happens, I guess.
Yeah, that would
be. I guess the next sort of thing to cover is, what do you think about this wacky lawsuit that's going on? The FCC allegedly using dead people to make pro-internet freedom comments.
We're waiting on the FCC to cooperate. I mean, I hope they haven't come to that. Have we really come to that, using dead people to, you know, promote your
Right.
But as far as kind of cooperating, I mean, can they be subpoenaed to force them to, or can they actually just continue to say, no, we're not going to show you our info?
I'm not really sure. Like, this is definitely a question I wish we had a lawyer who could sort of elaborate on. I think at a certain point, maybe they would be subject to a subpoena, but it is a state attorney general, and the Federal Communications Commission is a federal organization. And there is, like, the supremacy clause, which puts federal law above state law. But this is not, like, the FCC violating a law in regards to what it enforces. It's them sort of being involved in what I would consider illegal behavior.
Yeah.
If they have anything to do with this, that's bad. Like, you're the common myth of dead people voting in elections or whatever is one of the things, like voter fraud. It's essentially what this is. They tried to create a vocal outcry, and it was largely sort of fell on deaf ears because it was like it was. I remember people analyzing the comments and stuff, and it was a lot of like copy and paste type stuff that really looked indicative of what a bot was doing. And if it wasn't a bot, the FCC should just exonerate itself by cooperating with the investigation. This seems to be a theme in this administration of not cooperating with investigations in order to exonerate themselves. Like, that doesn't, it's not a good look for you when you don't cooperate. Like, if you have nothing to hide, then you should be cooperating, because this is not a witch hunt. You know, like, this is just, we have some serious issues on the board here. And if people don't want to cooperate with law enforcement, we're going to become a banana republic, you know, where the people with the most money really do control everything. Like, a lot of people think that's the case now, and to a certain degree, they're right. But we do have a justice system which is largely independent from the government. And it seems like the government, you know, the GOP in particular, is just doing everything it can to undermine the justice system at every opportunity, in my opinion, again. So, yeah, this is a bad direction, man. I'm not happy about any of this crap. Let's move on from this one. I support net neutrality. That's all I'm going to say on that. And if you want to debate me on this, you're more than welcome to.
Well, I would think everybody would.
I would hope so, but definitely not the case. All right. We're going to try something new for the second segment. Steven has done most of the legwork on this, and I'm going to let him take it away.
So last week, we talked about the tax cuts and job bill, and this week we're going to talk about it some more because there's more to it, and it really needs to be talked about. If this thing goes through, the Johnson Amendment of 1954 that prohibits all 501c3 nonprofit organizations from endorsing or opposing political candidates will no longer apply because Section 5201 of this bill would nullify it. Churches would, under this bill, be able to endorse and oppose any politician. Campaign donors would be able to make tax-deductible contributions through the churches, whereas now they're not tax-deductible. So, you know, this is just another way to give tax cuts to the rich.
And yeah, it's a real thing. Like, if you've ever made a tax or a contribution to a political campaign, and maybe thought, oh, this is tax deductible, right? Well, when you go to do your taxes, you would find out that you are not right. It is not tax deductible to contribute to a political campaign. That is you making a choice to spend your earned money that is being taxed on something that you support. This is a way around that.
Yeah.
And most certainly.
Donations of $250 or more to the churches are tax deductible. So that's all it has to be for that. And then, you know, they're going to funnel just massive amounts of money through there. I mean, the Joint Committee on Taxation projects this to be $2.1 billion loss to the Treasury over the next decade, which is about $6 to $8 billion in campaign donations. But it's not just through the churches. Under this bill, they'll be able to give, again, tax-deductible donations directly to the churches for advertisements on TV and radio and any church newsletters, you know, any social media they want to do, like even door-to-door campaign advertising, like whatever the churches want to do with it.
Which I assume all of this stuff is illegal right now, and churches are not allowed to conduct this sort of business.
Churches,
you probably lose your 501c3 status if you do this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, in addition to that, they'll be able to set up sham churches just to fund a campaign, and it'd be tax deductible. They'd still be able to deduct on their taxes like that.
Yeah, this definitely goes back to my previous point about the justice system. Here you have two laws that are at odds with each other. Now, when that happens, a case is absolutely going to be brought against this, and it's going to go before a judge, and a judge is going to decide, you know, which one is the one that we should... He's going to make a ruling that's going to basically, like, gut one law or the other law. Now, that could go a number of ways, but, I mean... Definitely seems like we're treading on dangerous ground here. I'm not an irreligious person myself, personally. I know anyone who probably knows Steven personally knows his feelings on this. But I very much do believe in the separation of church and state. I don't believe that, you know, religious freedom, in my opinion, is your ability to worship how you want. It's not your ability to thrust your religion on other people. And right. This is going to be a lot of religion being thrusted on you from however they want to do it. I mean, we already have problems with international contributions sort of being protected via Citizens United, that you can't see what's being put into a super PAC. How do you really know that it's an American contribution? So this potentially opens the door for many sorts of bad, dark money to come pouring in, especially when they know that they can line it up for things like this. It's just, this is not going to be a good look for the U.S., for certain.
No, and not even, you don't want the government putting pressure on churches. Like, I don't think they realize what they're asking for. Like, you know, anybody that within the churches that might be for this doesn't realize that, you know, once that money starts coming, there's going to be some expectations come along with it.
Yeah, that definitely is the thing, too. People get on the hook for money. That's a big problem with our politics right now. Like, you can see this in the GOP tax plan. Like, last week when I talked about the Lindsey Graham comment, they're trying to subsidize their donors with our tax dollars because their donors have paid a lot of money and they want a big tax cut. That's what they're after. When he said the money, the donations will stop, that's exactly what he referred to. The donations from the donors to the party. They're expecting a payoff. That's what they want. And the GOP is trying to deliver it to them at your expense. I heard some more intelligent people than myself talk about this a little bit. And one of the problems is that conservatives right now have this idea that conservative voters, mind you, have this sort of idea that they're better off if the federal government is reduced in power. One of the ways that they look to reduce it in power is just by bankrupting it. So they'll complain and moan about the debt when they're not in power. And then when they come into power, that seems to evaporate and they have no interest in dealing with the debt and they just want to like spend away.
Yeah, and they'll do it.
It becomes like a big giveaway for rich people, it seems like, every time they come to power. It's like, yeah, sure, I get a $250 tax break or a $1,000 tax break. If you're a single mom in Wisconsin or something and you make $30,000 a year, you will get $700 back. I'm going to say this again. $700 tax break. This is like $13 a week, okay? $700, I don't know what bubble Paul Ryan is living in, but $13 a week is not really tax relief for a single mom. Okay, I don't care what anybody says. Like, that's ridiculous.
So, moving on, some would say this is a religious freedom or First Amendment issue, but you know, it's really not. Right now, churches, they can talk about whatever policy issues they want to, and they do. The stipulation is they just can't endorse a candidate or they've got to pay taxes. You know, if you want to be involved in government, you got to contribute. It's as simple as that. And what this bill would do would be allow them to get involved and still not contribute. They still wouldn't have to pay taxes. Faith Voices has issued a letter to Congress, and so far it's been signed by over 4,000 religious leaders, urging them not to support this. They don't want their houses of worship divided by partisan politics, and I think they're right.
Yeah, this is just silly, man. Like, I don't... There's a reason why church and state are separated, and...
Yeah, and it's been like that since, you know, from our founding fathers, and they
Church has already toed the line on this stuff, it seems like, when it comes to endorsing political candidates. They're already, like... I mean, conservatives count on the sort of religious right to vote for them for the most part.
Evangelicals, definitely.
You do not see a lot of religious people, you know, openly supporting Democrats. So we're already at a point where we're toeing the line on this stuff pretty hard. And
you know, that's their whole angle too. They're just wanting to get more, you know, they think it's going to get them more votes.
Politics is about influence and power, man. Anything that you can do to increase your influence and power, you're going to have to expect a politician to try to do that. And it's incumbent on us as citizens to be aware of these moves and to sort of try to mitigate these problems. Because if we don't, nature abhors a vacuum, as they say. And Yeah, if you're not speaking out, if you're not talking to people, if you're not supporting the ideas that you think are right, if you're not taking an active role in civic duty.
Yep, get up, get out, make yourself heard, vote.
Yeah. This is the kind of stuff that's going to happen. I don't know if it's, like, I don't know how this is going to play out, but I don't think it's going to be good. It doesn't look good.
No, not so far, don't.
Looks like a lot of potential lawsuits. That's, I think, another thing that people didn't realize when Trump got elected is that you can sue the government. Like, that's absolutely real. You can sue the government, and the government has to sort, they answer to the court system. It doesn't matter what branch it is. And yeah, that's about, I mean, some days it feels like the only thing protecting us right now is our justice system. And that has major problems of its own that are not going to get fixed, you know, if we don't do something to deal with this. So, yeah. You got anything else, or you want to move on to the final segment?
I guess we'll just have to see how this plays out. You know, we'll stay on it, get any updates, and might definitely going to cover this again.
Yeah, today, I'm sure. Yeah, the tax plan stuff is certainly important. So until this thing is dead, I guess we're probably going to be talking about it to one degree or another for certain.